Today, tributaries will be joining the regenerative agriculture conversations of Cultivated Audio. Well, howdy. Let's just make July our own private month of the cowboy. Bob Kinford's had over 40 years in the saddle. His expertise dives in a bit deeper into handling cattle on horseback and holistic grazing without extra fencing. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for July 2021.
I realize that for anybody in doing conventional ranching, I am way out there in a whole nother world. Even people that are into the Bud Williams low-stress stockmanship, I'm over another notch out of the way of them. It's just good to get the word out, and maybe some people will get to thinking enough and start changing direction a little bit.
Yes, I think it's important for folks to have that heads up that, well, as I was going to start, you've been a cowboy slash horseman for the majority of your over 60 years. Why don't you give us a little bit of where you are from and where you've been ranching, and then we'll move into the instinctive migratory grazing.
I started out in Northern California, pretty close to halfway between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe on Highway 88. And my dad was an electrician. We're surrounded by farms and ranches. And I spent more time on the ranches helping with the livestock than I spent at home when I was a kid. And on this whole deal of the herd behavior for regenerative grazing, I started thinking about that when I was about 8 years old, because everybody's sheep would graze together. Everybody's goats would graze together. Their cows would scatter out. And I asked them why, and they go, well, that's just what cows do. And by the time I was about 11 or 12, I had ranchers that I wouldn't go help because they were just too wild with their animals. And I recognized that even at that early age, that it was what they were doing more than it was what the animals were.
Good eye, good feel.
And then I graduated from high school, and 4 days later, I was at Coulter Bay, Wyoming, guiding trail rides on a deep string. Went back for 1 year of college, then I was an electrician and industrial wiring, because my dad wanted me to be an engineer. And I took 1 year of it, took the apprenticeship test, didn't even get all the way into the union hall, got 1 foot in there. I just got sick to my stomach. I turned around, went back to Wyoming, spent 2 years in their service, and then I've been working cattle and horses and grass ever since then. Just turned 67 this week, so it's been a day or two.
All right. Well, happy birthday.
And oh, thank you.
Why don't you tell us about where you are ranching now and what the area is like for you in Texas, including rainfall and geography, et cetera?
Well, the only job I've had when I came here to Texas 16 years ago was on a little place. It was 3,500 acres, and they were building pivots on it. And we've had, it would have been 1,200 acres worth of pivots, and then the rest of it's native desert. For some reason, the owner decided that they had to go with Bermuda, which, if you can imagine, a grass that takes 28 to 36 inches of water to do good is going to not be very economically efficient in an area where it's costing you $900 an acre inch of water, and temperatures get up to close to 120.
Right. The name Bermuda might have been a clue, right?
But what is interesting about this is they went ahead in 2009, they sold it, or did a lease with an option to buy, to some people that they came in, they were going to do all this high quality feed and then put it through this little rundown feedlot that they had there, and they wanted me to stay and be a part of that. And I just looked at them. I said, there's no way that this is going to work, because you're going to have to deal with the Bermuda, and that Bermuda is going to take over everything. So they did it for a year and a half, and then they turned it over to somebody else. And that guy was a cotton farmer and did chilies. And so he just killed that Bermuda off spraying it. But then the water prices went up, and the last guy that leased the place, all he did is he planted everything and watered it to get it up, and then he walked off and took crop insurance. So it was sitting there, and we'd just moved here into Van Horn, and I was training a few horses, doing day work and trying to get my schools going. And I was driving by the place all the time, and 20 months ago now, I've been back on there. But tumbleweeds were over the top of the hood of your truck. You couldn't even drive through it with a tractor because it would ball up underneath the tractor and high center it. So the general manager over all those places had called me up and wanted to know if I could get it grazed off. Well, who wants to graze dormant tumbleweeds, right? Oh, you can't do that. Well, I got a guy talking. He sent me 145 head, and then he sent me another 100 and about 130 head a couple months later. They gained roughly a pound and a quarter a day on those dormant tumbleweeds. But that was not enough to get rid of 1,200 acres of tumbleweeds. It just wasn't. So,
were you surprised that the cattle thrived on that?
Oh, no. In fact, I did forage tests last year on this. They thought I was crazy at Texas A&M because I asked for the forage value on tumbleweeds that had just turned dormant and tumbleweeds that had been dormant for a year. The tumbleweeds that had just turned dormant had a total digestible nutrients of just over 48%, and the protein was still at 17%. Well, it takes basically 10% to be balanced for a cow's diet on the protein needs. The thing was that it was too low on calories to support a full-grown cow, pregnant cow. The tumbleweeds that were already a year old still had 5% protein.
Amazing.
So what I did is I was spraying the tumbleweeds from 2019 with molasses, and they were eating that and then going ahead and eating the tumbleweeds from last year. So I had 120 cows in two different bunches because they're two different owners through the winter, and I had a little bunch of 25 head that I was feeding. Well, now that we've got some rain, I've actually got some wheat growing where I was feeding them wheat hay, and I've got it cleared out enough to where I've got another fresh crop of wheat coming on. Strangely enough, still, I have Bermuda coming up on almost all of the pivots.
Do you think it's going to try to take over again?
Oh, yeah, but it's okay because it's not a bad thing because it's got a few other species. You know, there's a little bit of love grass in there.
Right, nice.
And other species of native grass. And going off the rainfall, it won't be able to choke things out as much.
Yes, good call.
But if I can have grass coming back when I hadn't even had 3 inches of rain last year, then I'm doing something good. If I would have had enough cattle, then I would have been able to do more. But at least it's a deal. It's showing up to where the neighbors, people driving through there, they can see that I'm getting more grass where these other places still don't have grass. They've got bare ground. So maybe there's some people start coming around to it and bring this grass back.
Yes. Now, is it mainly the cattle and the molasses that are doing the trick, or?
Well, it's the herd impact. They have all these different names for this, but I think the best thing to call it is biologically correct grazing.
Yes.
Because you've got to be able to stimulate the biology under the ground to stimulate biology on top of the ground. You know, so when you get the cattle moving in there enough to where they're kind of digging that ground up a little bit with their hooves and they're defecating and urinating on it, well, that is feeding all your microorganisms underneath the ground that feed your plants. And if you don't stimulate that biology underneath the ground, well, then nothing's going to come up.
Right, right.
Which is evident by the amount of bare ground or going out and looking at CRP ground that has been in it for 20 years. It really doesn't look much better than land that has been overgrazed and then sat.
Right. Now, CRP ground is?
It's Conservation Reserve. It's through NRCS, and they actually pay people to not graze.
Right.
Or to not use
good.
It. Mm-hmm. And they go in and they'll plant it and down here in love grass and sometimes four wing salt bush, and then they don't do anything with it. And it does good for about 5 years, and then it starts going backwards because it needs that biological impact of being grazed to be able to maintain itself.
Yes. Now, and every conversation about ranching, especially in these times, should include at least something about water. And considering what you've just been sharing, what can you say about the water? You got less than 3 inches, and yet it's still thriving.
Well, it's not still thriving. I didn't have hardly anything come up. I had some weeds come up last year, but nothing compared to what I do this year. And I've got 2 rain gauges on the place, one on the northwest end of it, and I've had 4.25 inches there and 5.25 in the rain gauge that's at the house, which is kind of the south central part of the place.
Mm-hmm.
But that 5 inches, we're still in a drought, but because I've prepped the ground with the animal impact, I'm getting a bigger response than the neighbors that, you know, kept their cattle scattered and
Right.
Just threw out cake and stuff on the same place all the time. They didn't get any impact. Their impact would be right there on the county road. They're going down, here comes the cows, drop some cake out and let them eat off the road.
Yes. Let's move into instinctive migratory grazing, or IMG as it's known. And it involves rebooting herd instinct, which is different, obviously, than the electric fencing method that's most prevalent in the holistic and regenerative grazing programs. Is it worth doing a little bit of compare and contrast, or is it best just to speak about the IMG method?
Well, yeah, there's compare and contrast. I've given a number of schools in Mexico, and all of them still use fences part of the time. In some areas, they'd already built them, so why not use them? They didn't go ahead and tear them out.
But sure.
They kind of use that as a tool, and it actually helps their cattle graze better when they're in the fences and keep them more relaxed. And this is where it gets kind of, I don't know how to put it, but everybody says that our cattle are relaxed. Sure, our cattle come running when we open the gate. And I can look at those cattle and tell that they're stressed, but the owner says, oh, no, they're not stressed. What do you mean? They're just coming to feed. Well, at this day and age, we all either have had someone that was a family member or a friend commit suicide, or have a friend or family member that had somebody that did, and nobody around the person had any clue that they were so stressed out with life that they were going to kill themselves.
Right.
Heck, I can't even, most of us can't even tell if our wife is mad until she pops us over the head with a skillet, you know? But we
do you
we
have a lot of lumps in your head?
You know, so these cattle that have been rebooted have just got a whole different look and feel and attitude to them. You can be out in 1,000-acre pasture or bigger, and you're going out there a couple times a week to go make sure that they're doing what you want them to do. And if they see you coming, they will actually turn to go to you and meet you. This isn't because they're getting fed, because we're not feeding them. We're not necessarily making a pasture move, but they see us coming, and they're looking to us for guidance. And they're just more relaxed in ways that you can't really put an accurate description on it. So comparing the two, you could do a direct comparison about it, but what I think the stockmanship end of it is something that everybody should be doing, whether they're wanting them to be a herd or not. Just because it relieves enough stress off the animals, it relieves stress off the people, which that goes into when it comes time to ship. You're shipping more pounds of cattle that's more profitable because you're not throwing money away by having shrink-related stress. And as Temple Grandel would say, that stress, a lot of that is actual tissue stress, and that doesn't come back for weeks. They get out of that stressful situation, and you put them out on pasture someplace else, and they'll start gaining a little bit faster, which is considered compensatory gain. But personally, I want an owner to keep that. I don't want them giving that away. So from that standpoint alone, it's important to pick up these stockmanship methods. But when you get out into this part of the world where a ranch may be 30,000 acres and up, and you've got pastures that are 10,000 acres or bigger, it's not economically feasible to try to fence all that off into small paddocks, because when you do the small paddocks, you also need more water points. And all of that adds up to things. It adds up to initial labor costs to get started. Then it adds up to more labor because you have to be out there every day making your move. You've got to be out there every day checking all your water points. To give you an example, a guy that was at the school I was at in Mexico, and he didn't make the change because his family sells electric fence, and they couldn't make the change without killing themselves on their fence sales.
Right.
But they bought an 18,000-acre place. They had Johan Zeitzman from South Africa take a look at it. Boy, they laid it all out. It was going to take 95 paddocks and 35 water points. So we sat down there, and we got his place on the map on Google Earth, and we went through and we laid out what I would have done on that place. And it was four pastures and five water points.
Amazing
difference.
He said
that would have saved him over $100,000 in infrastructure costs and cut his labor by more than half.
Right, and that's so amazing because I would guess that the thought of having to restructure their water places would put them into overdrive or just really deter them from shifting.
Well, yeah, it does. And when people can't wrap their minds around it, I've got friends that have got a ranch out here about 10 miles out of town. And they think I'm plumb crazy. You know, you can't run cattle like that in the desert. Their water system, they would actually only have to add about 6 or 7 miles of water line to hook up every water line that they've got into one water system. And from there, rather than having all these water points scattered around the ranch where you can water 20 head of cows here and 20 head of cows over there to keep them scattered out, they can take and pull them out, turn them off, and congregate them in a couple different places. And all of a sudden, they can run 800 head at a time and not have a strain on their water system. In fact, one thing that makes that work better is that on that whole ranch, they only need to have one water point running, so all your water is going there rather than 20 sets of cattle watering in 20 different places, and any ones that are at the top end of the water line, they run out of water. They have to wait until everybody else's drinkers gets filled up and shut off before they get in. So it actually makes it easier to water your cattle all at once. And then since you're doing it that way, you can actually have all your water all around the ranch, shut off, make one day a week or one day a month where you go around and you freshen it up so the wildlife can have something to drink, turn it back off. It's unbelievable the amount of mileage that a person can cut off by doing that. You know, when I worked out at the Circle Ranch, they had three pastures in a row. They could have combined their water points into three places instead of the scattered out ones they have. And that right there would have reduced their mileage 1,100 miles a year on checking water because they got to check three times a week.
Sure. Wow.
So it can do a lot to cut down labor and cut down your expenses, but then it's also improving your grass, getting your cattle to eat browses that they're not eating now because they're too dependent upon their supplements. So you're lowering costs there, and then because you're building grass, you can run more cows, and your overhead cost per cow goes down. And we're not sure what the ratio is for number of cows per person. Ranching for Profit says you should have 1,000 cows for every full-time employee dedicated to cattle. Well, Chris Jorgensen, he was looking for somebody to help, and he had no problem on keeping track of 1,800 head of cows and moving them around and doing the whole thing by himself. So that's almost double.
Yes.
What Ranching for Profit says. That's another deal, but that's a big drop of labor cost.
Yes, that's huge. And hearing what you're saying, it's hard for me to believe that people are questioning what you're doing. And covering the water like this, that must be a huge relief also for the cattle in bringing down kind of stress level.
It's hard for people to wrap their mind around. And even Bud Williams was convinced that cattle naturally graze apart. We're still caught in the paradigm that you hurt the grass if you have the cattle too close together. I've met people that have graduated from Texas A&M within the last 4 years that have never heard of Richard Teague. Well, Richard Teague is the one who came out with an adaptive multi-paddock raising study with Texas A&M And if you're studying right under him, you hear about it. But if you're in the classes, his research hasn't made it into the classroom of the thinking university he is working for. That is just mind-boggling to me. I mean, they're still quoting Brisk, you know?
It's so true. And so much of that happens in the human medical world as well. It's kind of mind-blowing how long these things take to actually become common knowledge or at least be available to the common man, so to speak.
If you've done research and, you know, your whole education is wrapped up in how well you know this research, and you're on the peer review board for this, you're going to resist anything that challenges what you think of as fact. So the teachers that are teaching that have to get out of the way before it's actually going to get commonplace in the classroom.
Right. I'm really happy to hear about your schools, but before we get there, I'd like you to share a little bit about, you know, you said when you looked at certain cattle, you'd say, wow, your cattle are stressed, and they're saying, well, no, they're not. What do you see when you see stressed cattle? What is it that you're seeing?
Okay, let's look at this from the fact that cattle are a herd animal. Just by the definition of being a herd animal, what do they do? They come together and they graze as a herd. So if you go out there and you look at the cattle and they're scattered across that pasture instead of being in a herd, you know, they've got some stress coming in.
Right, ground zero, yes.
Yeah, that's ground zero. Now, the other thing, and this is real big on a lot of these places using the multiple paddocks, is, oh, well, look at this, our cows, they're right here at the gate. They're wanting us to come in. Well, I've been on these places where they were belly deep in feed, but the place was doing a daily move. And these cows, at the time for their move, if they were doing it at 6 o'clock in the morning, by 5:45, they were bellowing and going across and going to that gate. They had enough food there. I mean, that's a Pavlov's dog syndrome right there. They know they're supposed to be getting moved in, and they're going to move. And the place that really stands to mind was at Alejandro Carrillo's place, that Rancho de los Damas in Mexico, and they were losing, I can't remember how many percentage of calves that they were losing, because the cows were moving off and the grass was so thick the calves couldn't follow, but those cows just knew they had to go to that fresh meat. And between the time that they would go up and then come back, coyote would get them. So...
Wow.
I mean, that right there is stress. And it's interesting because when I was doing this out here on the pivots, I was working with a manager that, boy, he really believed in the fences. And he was a Bud Williams guy with doing the back and forth across the back. Well, we'd go out and going to bring in a set of cattle that I had going. And I'd say, well, let's just go up there. I'll go out and get them started this way to the front. Oh, you don't do it that way. He goes out around there to the back, and when cattle are tight like that, they have to go in three directions because they can't just force their way up through the front. So some go up the front, some go off to the right, and some go off to the left. Well, we'd go in and we'd work those cows, and then he'd help bring them back. And he'd be, boy, you got to be on the back, going back and forth across that. And when those cattle, you put them back in that pivot, rather than going into a herd, it was just like they were marbles and somebody just taking a handful of marbles and just throw them down. I mean, they were just scattered across the whole pivot.
And so how do you remedy that?
Oh, I just go back out there and, you know, I got to check them. So every time I check them, I just start riding through them a way that kind of just draws them into one another. And after 2 or 3 days, they'd be back into their little herd and working their way around the pivot.
And then that's all it took?
Yeah. It doesn't take a lot.
Right.
But it takes some degree of preciseness. I kind of liken it to a potter with a piece of clay on a potter's wheel. You know, that clay spinning around doing its own thing. And you reach out and you're grabbing hold of it and you're putting pressure on it, but the clay is finding relief by going to where you want it to go.
Without too much pressure.
And that's what I'm doing when I'm going on cattle. I will approach them in a way to where their release is in the direction I want them to go.
Nice.
Which means rather than going out and going around the cow, I go right directly to it, or a group of cows, and then I'll see a reaction, and as soon as I get that reaction, I change my direction. Sometimes I've got to change it more than once, but those cattle, rather than running off, will turn around, and they will go either around me, around and by me, or they'll just turn around and go by me in the direction I want them to go. And I'm not chasing them after I do it. I just let them go. And after a few times of this, they start relaxing down, and they actually want to come together as a herd. So on the schools, what I do is we go out, and we kind of go through the different approaches and get these cattle all going same water point at the same time, because cattle have got a schedule where they eat, they drink, then they'll sit there and let the rumen work and ruminate for 2 to 4 hours, and then they go out and graze again. So if you just go out there and handle these cows, they're going to come together somewhat, but until you get their rumen cycling at about the same time, they're not going to totally come together as a herd, because, you know, some of them, well, it's time to go get a drink. And for the other ones, well, they don't need a drink yet. Part of the herd goes in, they get a drink, they're laying around, they're ruminating, and then they go out to grazing. And then the next bunch decides, oh, well, guess it's time to go to water. So you've got all these cattle that are on different water rumination schedules. So you get them going on that same schedule, and then when it's time to go to water, they all go to water. When it gets time for them, you know, they're done ruminating and they're going to go out and graze, they're all ready at the same time.
Hmm. Now, speaking of them grazing, cattle graze differently at different times of the year. Do they eat down more of a plant in certain times of the year?
Well, okay, this all boils down to your stockmanship and how much stress they have on. We have found that these herds, that you get them rebooted during the growing season, they're taking the top third of the grass plant. That's where the most nutrition is. But at the same time, cows that have got stress on them, they eat more of the plant. And this is another discussion that I was having with Temple Grandin the other day, because I've seen where you could put 1,100 calves on a pivot of Bermuda, and they go around, they eat that top third. Then you've got another 1,100 calves on an identical pivot of Bermuda, but they're sitting over there with the fences, and they're doing the forced daily moves rather than just let them ease around there at their own schedule as a herd. And those cattle are eating it down to the ground, and they have to be moved off the pivot faster than the ones that are just in the top third.
Wow, amazing.
What Temple said is that, yeah, you've got your area of nutrition that your bacteria can really work well, and then when you get outside of that, you're making the bacteria have to work harder. And the two sets of cattle will actually gain at the same rate, but the one is taking more than twice the amount of feed to do it. It's eating the part that doesn't have the nutrition in it.
The conclusion with Bob Kinford can be heard by going to tributariesradio.wordpress.com or by going to one of the many podcast platforms. For anything Tributaries related, it's the same. Get in touch if you like. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.